because of our recording purposes. With that said, I'm going to ask our marshal to call the next case for consideration.
Now calling case number 8220767 in the matter of the Jones C. Rinaldo Trust.
And when you're ready to proceed, please do.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Andrew Bardwell with the firm of Skolnick and Bardwell, PA. I represent the appellants Rochelle Casey, Lawrence Rinaldo, and Thomas Rinaldo, who were the petitioners below. I'd like to spend my time this morning talking about what I believe are three important legal issues that are before the court. The first one relates to the proper application of Minnesota Statute Section 501C. 0.1002, which, as the court knows, is a relatively new statute without a lot of case law guiding its interpretation. The second issue I will touch on is what it means for a trustee to properly exercise their discretion. The third issue relates to who bears the burden of proof with respect to a trustee's accounting. With respect to Minnesota Statute Section 501C.1002, this is a relatively new statute having been enacted in 2016. As the district court pointed out in its decision, there really is a dearth of case law providing guidance on how to apply this statute. What we do know is that that statute was based on the Uniform Trust Code, which is in turn based upon largely upon the restatements of law are related to trusts. So there's some guidance to be found there. The statute itself, which is titled Damages for Breach of Trust, includes in relevant part the following. A trustee who commits a breach of trust is liable for the greater of the amount required to restore the value of the trust property and trust distributions to what they would have been had the breach not occurred, or the profit the trustee made by reason of the breach. In this case, there's no dispute that the trustee breached her fiduciary duties by purchasing from the trust two rental properties for less than the fair market value. There's no dispute that those properties continued to appreciate. There's no dispute that the trustee collected rental income from those properties.
Because the district court acknowledged that, but your argument on that is that the remedy was not correct in terms of, I mean, the district court attempted to turn back the clock, if you will, and required the trustee to make payment to the estate. I mean, I understand you want to remove, but is that the gist of your argument, is that the remedy that was fashioned by the court is incorrect? Because the court did recognize she had not followed protocol.
Exactly, Your Honor. We take issue with the remedy. What the appellants had requested of the trial court was that those transactions, those conflicted transactions, be unwound and the properties be returned to the trust so they could be then sold in an arm's length transaction and the proceeds could be properly distributed. It is our belief, and I think the evidence that was submitted to trial shows that that would have been a greater remedy. There would have been more benefit to the trust and the beneficiaries if that was done. And that is exactly what the statute in question requires. It's the greater of.
I thought it was kind of persuasive, though, the argument that she was permitted to purchase it. What she wasn't permitted to do is purchase the property at less than market value.
Sure.
So the profit that was caused is her paying less. Why is that? Why does that violate? I think you're saying it's an error of law. As an error of law, could the district court not? If the profit achieved was that she actually spent less, she then restores that.
Well, so I think in order to get to the answer to that question, we need to look historically at how these transactions were treated and what remedies were imposed. And historically, a trustee was not allowed at all to deal with trust property. So there could never be a transaction where a trustee bought from the trust, even if they paired.
Trust expressly allowed it, counsel. So
and we I'm getting to that. We have a...
I'm wondering why that matters.
Sure. That is a change in the law. The trust now allows the trustee to deal with the trust, but the same concerns that existed before exist, and they're actually heightened. The reason a trustee wasn't allowed to transact business with the trust before was the risk was too great that the trustee would take advantage of that position. That risk is...
The safeguard set up, that was set up by law, but as Judge Cochran says, this mother specifically wanted that to happen.
Yes.
And whether she was taken advantage of, she would have been advised, presumably, at the time that she drafted the trust. And that's not for us to say anyway, but, I mean, she signed a document
sure.
that allowed that.
And the question remains, what is the remedy when the trustee violates that trust that was placed in them? And historically, that remedy has been very strong. It's been robust to deter this type of conduct. And since now a trustee can actually transact with the trust, it's even more important that there are strong remedies to dissuade that improper conduct. And that's
why... I would agree, though, that 501C.1001 provides a variety of remedies that the court may order. So... How did the court abuse its discretion in basically trying to make the trust whole, which is provided for under 501C.1002, rather than setting up a constructive trust or requiring the properties to be, you know, returned and resold?
Your Honor, it's the first clause of 1002. The trustee is liable for the greater of. So we have to look at the greater remedy and the greater return of profit to the trust.
So what can you specifically identify the profit then? Because your brief, I don't think, was particularly clear on that point. I know you think it's more than just the difference in price, but what can you identify what that profit is that you don't think was
Certainly,
provided for under the order.
There was evidence at trial that the properties had continued to appreciate after the 2018 date in which they were purchased.
How is that a profit? I mean, within the meaning of the statute.
Historically, when a trustee breached their duties, they were required to disgorge all profit, regardless of the source. And here... It should be the same analysis to dissuade this conduct in the future. The trustee must disgorge all profit that they garnered as a result of this transaction. And if you look at the remedies proposed in the restatements upon which this is based, when the trustee is on both sides, if the beneficiaries ask that the properties be returned, the transaction be unwound, and it's feasible to do so, that is the preferred remedy. And here it is feasible.
Even when a transaction was expressly authorized? Or are those cases dealing with a breach and actually even engaging in the transaction?
So I think the important piece is that it is a conflict of interest transaction where the trustee benefits improperly. Now, certainly she was authorized to purchase the properties. She was not authorized to purchase them for less than their fair value. So we have a breach of her fiduciary duty. Once we've established the breach, the question is the remedy. And the statute...
The breach was, I know we're saying a lot, but the breach is to the second part of that, which is she's permitted to buy, but not permitted to buy at less than. And that's what's breached, is that second duty.
And I don't think there's anything in the statute or in the case law that would suggest the trustee who breaches that duty is somehow liable for less.
So what does the word profit mean in this statute? I mean, and I looked at Black's Law Dictionary, and it defines profit as the excess of revenues over expenditures in a business transaction. So it's not even clear to me that there is a profit here. She had a savings, but and that's why the trust needs to be made whole, because she didn't pay the fair market value. But did she really profit as that term is defined?
So cases interpreting trust law would look at it, if an asset appreciates, that's profit. We have evidence.
And what case would you cite us to find the definition of profit for purposes of trust law?
I don't know that there is a clear one that gives a definition of profit. I think you take it from numerous different holdings where, and the restatements themselves, where it talks about, for example, if a trustee engages in an inappropriate transaction with a trust and the value of that asset goes down, the trustee is still liable for the full amount. If the value of the asset goes up, and if the value of the asset goes up, the trustee is liable for the profit, the amount that it went up. And here the properties continue to go up in value.
But that's a different scenario than this situation.
The uniting factor is that the trustee received an improper benefit. What we have previous case law in situations, and this is the comment to the restatement that the trustee cites, talking about if the trustee receives too little consideration, they just pay the difference. Well, that's a circumstance where the trustee is not on both sides of the transaction and didn't improperly personally benefit. Here, the trustee was on both sides, and though they were authorized to engage in the transaction, they weren't authorized to personally benefit from the transaction. So if we play it forward with the rule that the trustee proposes, a trustee would be essentially free to take their chances in paying too little for an asset, and only if they're called out later pay the difference. That essentially incentivizes them to be dishonest and to misdeal with the trust. We are proposing that the appropriate rule is the one that has always been applied. When a trustee breaches their fiduciary duty, they must disgorge all profit, not just some of it. Unless the panel has any more questions on that subject, I'll move on to questions of discretion.
Go ahead.
There were a number of instances where the district court determined that actions taken by the trustee were appropriate exercises of discretion. One of which related to the trustee's decision to use the lowest of the date of death appraisals to establish the trust inventory and the estate tax return. The court was correct that the trust did give the trustee discretion in tax matters. However, there's no evidence the trustee actually exercised any discretion. Now, there is a test for trustee's discretion that was laid out in In Re Trusts A and B of Divine, 672 Northwest 2nd, 912. That was a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 2004. It lays out a six-factor test to examine an exercise of discretion. And of those six factors, there's two that are highly important here. That's factors 5 and 6, the motives of the trustee in exercising or refraining from exercising the power. And 6, the existence or non-existence of an interest in the trustee conflicting with that of the other beneficiaries. And by using those lower appraisals to set the trust inventory and the estate tax return, the trustee deprived the trust and its beneficiary of the benefit of a stepped-up basis in those assets. And what that means essentially is if you purchase an asset, say you purchase something for $100,000, you own it for 20 years, it's now worth $1 million. If you sell it, you have to pay capital gains tax on that increase in the price. If you hold that asset until after you pass away, your heirs then get the stepped-up basis, which is the value as the date of death, which would be $1 million. So if they sell it, there's no capital gains. Here, had the trustee used the higher date of death appraisals to set the inventory and the estate tax return, there would have been no capital gains on the future sales. She acknowledged that in her testimony, that the trust was deprived of that benefit because she did it, and she was able to buy the properties at a lower price because she used the lower appraisals. So she was interested in the transaction, interested in that exercise of discretion. It only benefited her, and it was a detriment to the trust. That can't be a reasonable exercise of discretion.
So, and I'm sorry that I may not understand this, but if she had, in fact, purchased at the higher date of death appraisal, right? She purchased it. So, and then she just owns it. There's not a future sale. That is the sale. She owns it. And let's say then that she had used that stepped up. She had purchased it for the higher amount.
Sure.
How is the trust harmed relative to, like, the basis? Because she owns it now.
Sure. So the harm is in this. The district court awarded a damage number based on the Tulo sales price and then reduced that damage number by sort of a fictional calculation of capital gains. And that reduction was based solely on the use of these lower date of death appraisals. Had she used the higher date of death appraisals and set the higher stepped up basis, there would have been no capital gains at that sales price. So it only benefited the trustee.
So it's in the reduction.
Yeah, exactly. It was about $25,000 reduction in the damage figure that is implicated there.
The district court found that the taxes were prepared by her accountants, and the trust gives the trustee the authority to rely on her accountant's advice without further investigation. And you don't appear to challenge the finding that the taxes were prepared by her accountants. So given that she can rely on her accountants, how did the district court err in finding that there wasn't an abuse of
Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time, but I would like to answer your question.
Sorry.
Quite simply, there was no testimony from any accountant. Mr. Torreson, I believe, testified. He did not testify that the accountants chose the appraisals to use. I believe he didn't know there were multiple appraisals. And the trustee herself didn't testify, hey, the accountant told me to use those appraisals. That is not in the record. It didn't happen. She didn't have any explanation for why she used the lower appraisals, except the effect that it allowed her to purchase them at a lower price. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Francis Rondoni. I'm with the law firm of Chestnut Cambrone, and I represent Julie Meredith, who is the trustee and the respondent in this matter. The petitioners are her siblings. Judge Sigmundson conducted a two-day trial in 2021. She made detailed findings of fact, 22 pages, in fact. And in those, she determined the credibility of any conflicting evidence. She also then issued an order regarding fees for the trustee and attorney's fees. That's another 11 pages, detailed findings of fact.
There's one finding, I shouldn't say a finding, it's a footnote, I believe, but it's white elephant in the room. Why doesn't anyone ever talk about Article 4, the allocation of the remaining trust, 4.3, that says if somebody challenges the distribution that you're essentially disinherited?
Yes, and the judge, Sigmundson, actually pointed out that that was not an issue.
Yeah.
So the reason is that the case law, as it's been developed, basically says that if there is a good faith basis for the challenge, the courts are not going to enforce that provision. So we did not bring it up because...
Thank you. Those are the things that distract us from what the issues are on appeal.
All right. So... counsel mentioned the burden of proof, and I know the court knows this, but for findings of fact, it's clearly erroneous. For conclusions of law, it's de novo. And for equitable relief, it's abuse of discretion. And it is our position that the court really did an excellent job here in terms of findings. Let me talk about remedies, since counsel spent a fair amount of time on that. I think it's important to understand the court did not find a breach of duty to the trust, a breach of the trust, because the transaction to purchase out of there was allowed. What the court found was a breach of duty of loyalty, and that had to do with the pricing. So let's take a look at what the...
Help me understand what you just told us. Are you saying that 501c.1002 doesn't apply, that there wasn't a breach of the trust within the meaning of that statute?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay, and did maybe I didn't quite see that articulated in your brief in that manner. Did you make that argument in your brief?
I believe that we did, Your Honor.
Go ahead. I just wanted to make sure I understand you're arguing here today.
So, and I think I can clarify that. There is no breach of the trust because of what the trust provided, but even if 501c1002 applied, if you take a look at the measure of damages, it's exactly the same under 1 and 2 in this case. In other words, the amount required to restore the trust property, which is the difference in value, or the profit the trustee made, which at the time, again, is the difference in value. We don't think that that applies, but even if it did, I think the measure of damages is correct the way the court determined them in this case.
So what does the term profit mean for purposes of that statute?
The only conclusion that I think can be drawn would be the difference between what you should have paid and what you paid.
So then here it would be the difference between what she paid and what the district court found was the midpoint for the 2018 evaluation.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that.
Okay. And given that, then does it really make sense to reduce it by the capital gains? Because the capital gains is something paid by the trust, not paid by her individually. So she still, in terms of her profit, then her profit really is just the difference. Help me understand why the capital gains would be accounted for if you look at Clause 2. I understand why it would be accounted for in Clause 1 because that's the value of restoring the value to the trust.
Mm-hmm.
And capital gains is something the trust pays. But in terms of profit of the trustee, she doesn't pay capital gains. So her profit really, if you measure it in that manner, is the difference between the two.
I can see the court's argument there, and I think that would probably be a correct analysis that could be made here. I don't think that this statute applies in that manner, and I think what the court tried very hard to do was to put the trust in the exact position it should have been in had she paid the correct amount.
So you're saying then that a breach of the duty of loyalty is not a breach of the trust. It's a different type of breach.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. In fact, that's exactly what the court says, and I can quote the findings, but here's where the court really addresses the damages issue. The court finds the petitioners have requested the properties be returned to the trust. In other words, make the transactions void. But the court finds that is not an appropriate remedy. Julie had a right to purchase the properties from the trust, but should have paid a slightly higher price. Having her pay the difference in what was a fair market price and the price she paid fully compensates the trust. The court finds the petitioner is disingenuous in arguing that the property should be returned to make them whole. She says that does not reflect the damage done by Julie. The court finds that she should reimburse the trust $67,987. The other thing to keep in mind...
Can we go back to this issue that I should have focused more on earlier in the looking at the briefs, but I now understand that this argument's very helpful in this regard. As to what a breach of the trust is, because if you look at, you're looking at 501c.1002, and it says a trustee who commits a breach of the trust is liable for the greater of, and then it lists, you know, one and two. But if you go back to 501c.1001, it says a violation by a trustee of a duty of a duty the trustee owes to a beneficiary is a breach of the trust. And isn't the duty of loyalty a duty that the trustee owes to the beneficiary?
Yes, Your Honor.
So then wouldn't it be a breach of the trust under the language of the statute?
I would argue that they are different. The breach of loyalty is exactly that. There's a duty of loyalty. A breach of the trust means that you did something that is contradicted by the terms of the trust. One of the places I think that we can find guidance to in determining whether or not the transaction should be voided is if you take a look at another provision of the Act, which is 501c0802, the Trust Act, it talks about when a transaction should be voided. And there it says a sale by a trustee of trust property to his or herself can be avoided by a beneficiary unless, sub 1, The transaction was specifically authorized by the terms of the trust, and that's the case that we have here. In terms of the other facts, I'm prepared to discuss a lot of the other findings that are covered in the materials if the court would like me to do so. But in terms of the remedies, it's our position that the district court here did an excellent job. She determined that the trustee, who is a layperson, this is not a professional trustee, this is a woman that had took care of the trust with her mother when she was alive, filed 10 to 15 years of tax returns for whatever reason her mother didn't file in her lifetime, had to manage all these properties, get them sold, and really did a good job, did an estate sale, and the court found her to be very credible and that her intent was never a malintent, including the fact that she had notified the appellant's petitioners in writing that she was going to use the date of death appraisal amount. Now, even though she informed them of that, very transparent, it was an error. And we accept the court's findings. We don't necessarily agree with them, but we accept those court's findings. But at the end of the day, this is three disgruntled children, siblings, who are bringing an action because she paid slightly, according to the court, slightly too little for the properties. And at the end of the day, that's what this case is about. The court found everything else that she did not damage the trust. She had collected some money from Bruce Collada that she kept in cash along with some jewelry that her mother wanted her to distribute in that manner. The court said, look, we know you did that in good faith, but you're not supposed to do it that way. You're supposed to put it in the trust. If the court does not have any further questions, I'll conclude.
It appears not. Thank you.
Thank you. So in conclusion, here's what I would like to point out to the court. The district court in this case, Judge Kristen Sigmason, heard all this testimony and evidence over a two-day period. The appellants in their brief largely are re-arguing just their one side of the case. And the burden here is on them to show that the findings were clearly erroneous, and there's really nothing in their materials that would show that at all, other than they regurgitated their one side of the case. As I indicated just a moment ago, we have a non-professional trustee who did, I think, a darn good job under the circumstances, made an error or two of judgment that the court found to be in good faith, but required her to return some of the money to the trust. So she returned $70,000 to a $1.4 million trust. At this point, it is our position that the district court did an excellent job, that the findings are supported, that there's nothing she did that was a violation of existing law or existing fact, and that her findings are not clearly erroneous. So we would ask that you affirm her decision in full. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. There was a reference to Minnesota Statute 501C0802 talking about voiding what transactions can be voided, and it's that statute that allows the trust to contain the language that authorizes the transactions where a trustee has a conflict. Absent that statute, those transactions couldn't be conducted. But that statute, 0802, does not authorize a trustee to breach the trust by paying too little. And Judge Cochran, you're absolutely right. A breach of the duty of loyalty is a breach of the trust. It says so in the statute. I don't think there's any support for a contrary position anywhere. So by paying too little in a transaction where the trustee had an interest, the trustee breached the trust, violated her duty, and 1002 applies. The remedy should be the greater amount of damages. There's one other important piece there. The trustee never testified that she would have paid more for the properties if she understood they were worth more. Her testimony was that she paid the fair market value. So to essentially give her a mulligan, say, you know what, okay, it's all right, you didn't pay enough, you cheated the trust, but if you pay a little more now, it's okay. Despite the fact that you've reaped the windfall of the appreciation of the properties and the rents you've collected that would have been properly paid over to the trust.
Although she would have reaped those if she had paid the right amount, too.
Correct, but there's no evidence that she was willing to pay more than what she paid. Her testimony was, I paid the fair market value.
Does it matter that...
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'll see to you.
Oh, she did, after the district court issued its order, it's my understanding that she did pay the money judgment of $67,988.
That is true, but I don't believe that impacts the analysis of what happened prior.
My question is this. Does it matter that the trial court didn't come up with words like intentionally did something or willfully did something? Because when I read the district court court order, it appears to say mistake.
That's a fair question.
Is a lesser...
That's a fair question, Your Honor. The court did conclude that she breached her fiduciary duties. Whether that was intentional or a mistake, I don't believe is relevant. The conclusion is she breached her fiduciary duties. That is a breach of the trust. The statute with remedies must apply because she breached her duties. And so that's the appropriate analysis, not whether or not it was intentional or flagrant or anything like that. The fact is the court found she breached her duties. I believe this is an important issue because it's going to come up again in the future. This, as we discussed, it's a new statute. It's going to have to be interpreted again in the future. And the reading that the trustee proposes would leave the trust essentially unprotected anytime a trustee decides to act inappropriately. And that's contrary to historically how trusts were governed. It was always deemed as so important that that position was in such a position of power and had such temptation that there needed to be strict remedies if the trustee fell to that temptation. We are advancing a rule that's consistent with history and consistent with precedent that would keep the trust and its beneficiaries protected in the event that a trustee acts nefariously.
But isn't the remedy that you're suggesting, or your argument that this remedy is required, isn't that inconsistent with the plain language of the statute that says the court may? I mean, there's nothing in the statute that requires the court to impose the remedy that you're seeking here.
Well, I don't know that that's entirely true. 1002 says the court should impose the greater of. And here, the evidence is that it would have been a greater recovery to the trust to unwind the transaction. The profit the trustee received was greater than the amount to restore the trust. So the statute dictates it is supposed to be the greater of. That is an instruction to the court that I would say limits the discretion from 1001.
That assumes that we agree with you that the court erred in its determination of what the profit was.
Agreed, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Unless the court has any more questions, we would request that the decision be reversed as to those damages and remanded with an instruction to properly apply 1002 and unwind the transactions. Thank you.
Thank you to both of you for appearing today. Your briefs were helpful, the argument extremely helpful, and the matter is deemed submitted, which means a decision will be issued in the 90-day statutory timeframe.
Thank you, Your Honor.